Hello everyone and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
I'd say that there's at least 100 people here. There are children from the ages of 5 to literally 3 months old.
Inside the harrowing trek to America, Vice News host Paola Ramos tells us what migrants really face on their dangerous journey through the jungle. Then, gridlock in yet another Israeli election as Palestinians gear up for theirs, the first in 15 years. Candidate and former Foreign Minister Nasser al-Kidwa on what all this means for peace and human rights in the region. Plus,
you have a lot of thousands of officers who want to serve, who really want to do the right thing. And you have some that are attracted to it for all the wrong reasons.
Reimagining policing. Tracy Kesey and Philip Atiba Goff, co-founders of the Center on Policing Equity, tell our Michelle Martin what it will take to bring real reform. Plus, a world-class pianist returns home, Mahani Teave, on what drove her to create Easter Island's first music school. Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour in London. A group of Senate Republicans is at the U.S.-Mexico border today, a response to the wave of migrants trying to gain entry into the United States. Texas Senators Cruz and Cornyn are calling the situation a crisis, while President Joe Biden says that it's not. He says the surge is something that happens every year at this time, for seasonal reasons. Still, the number of children and unaccompanied minors is a cause for concern. While the focus right now is very much on the border, it's important to remember that the actual story is outside the border and that the journey there can start much, much further away than we realize. Vice News correspondent Paola Ramos headed down to Colombia's border with Panama and joined migrants as they trek through the dangerous jungles known as the Darien Gap. Here's a clip from her report.
On the trail are poisonous snakes, scorpions, and jaguars. Yet far worse are the gangs looking for prey. The migrants are vulnerable to being robbed at any time, and many women become victims of sexual assault and rape.
So far, the two women that were in front of me at the beginning have been left behind. They started with shoes, and I saw them completely barefoot by the time I left them. At this point, I don't really know where they are. Ahead of me, it's pretty silent, it's pitch black. The one thing you can hear, though, the murmuring of children. That's the one thing that you can hear.
Paola Ramos is joining us now from New York. Welcome back to the program, Paola. And you have been following this issue of migration for a long time. Tell me why you chose that particular border.
I think when we're trying to understand what is driving migrants to the United States, you have to understand the desperation. And I think in that border, through that jungle, you understand that migrants are so desperate to reach the United States. They're so desperate to attain this American dream that we're constantly talking about, that they are willing to risk their lives and cross up to 10 days through one of the world's most dangerous jungles, which is El Darién. And so in that jungle, you recognize what desperation means. You also recognize that migrants aren't just coming from Central America. They're coming from all different parts of the world. And you understand that the journey to the U.S. can look many different ways.
And we heard, obviously, in the clip, you talking about jaguars and scorpions. And what else is there that makes it so dangerous? 10 days through the jungle is unbearable to even think of. Are there I don't know, gangs and other such things?
That's right. Of course. So to give everyone an idea, this is 66 miles of jungle, right? This is between Colombia and Panama. In the Colombian side of the jungle, that's controlled by El Clan del Golfo. El Clan del Golfo is one of Colombia's most powerful cartel groups. And so there really is no way of crossing that part of the jungle without their yes, right? Without their affirmation. So you first depend on them to cross. You're not only then encountering different types of animals, but once you make it to the Panamanian side of the border, it was so dangerous that even our crew, our Vice News crew, had to leave because the Panamanian side is what is more known as the lawless territory. Every single migrant that I spoke to, once they had finished that route, every single one of them told me that they had been robbed in that side, that they had seen dead bodies, And many, many people had seen other women being raped. And that's everything that is happening on the Panamanian side of El Darién. I didn't talk to a single person that had not been attacked in a different version of that.
So I don't know whether you crossed as, you know, with the migrants on the Panamanian side, but you certainly talked to some of the coyotes. So, of course, those are the human traffickers. They're the smugglers. They're the people that extort or extract money from the migrants. And they're also the people who are telling the migrants right now that, hey, you can come across because Joe Biden says it's okay, which he doesn't. But I want to play a clip of you talking to one of these coyotes.
Estos años ha cambiado más en la forma en que ahora hubo cambio de presidente. Como pasó anteriormente hace 8 años atrás. Estaba el presidente Obama. Hubo ingresos bastante inmigrantes por aquí.
¿Diría usted que el migrante se ha convertido en un negocio para ustedes?
No es exactamente un negocio, una fuente más de empleo.
¿Ustedes les cobran cuánto a los migrantes?
Se les está cobrando $400 y $350.
Se sabe que hay migrantes que han perdido la vida en esta trayectoria.
Sí, es muy claro. Desespero. Ganas de caminar por donde sea con tal de llegar a la zona de los Estados Unidos. No se sabe qué les espera más adelante. La ansiedad que yo pienso únicamente es el sueño americano.
So, yeah, you know, he says they want the American dream, but I guess, did you know, you saw him close up. I guess you could look into his eyes. Do they have any sense of what they're doing to these people, you know, taking their money, abandoning them, and you know, condemning them to a terrible existence and maybe even death?
Well, I can tell you that they think that they're doing them a service, right? They think that without their help, they would essentially die as they're trying to trek the Colombian side of El Darién, right? And that's one of the questions that I ask them. And why are you doing this? They don't see it as a criminal act. Obviously, that's a whole other discussion. They are, let's remember, they are working within El Clan del Golfo. Now, they are cartel groups. They're not just trafficking migrants. They're also trafficking cocaine in those very same territories that I was in. But they see this as a way to help the migrants survive this extremely treacherous jungle. And I have to say, yes, migrants, the cartels have directly profited from this whole border crisis or border surge, however we want to name it. And that's something that was true, not just now, but also under President Trump, right? Under President Trump, more than 24,000 migrants crossed that same jungle, amongst them at least 4,000 children. And so the cartels are one of the people that are directly profiting from all of these stranded migrants that are all over the continent.
And Paola, you know, people in the press conference said to President Biden, it's because you're a nice guy that they're coming. And he just batted that away. He said, you know, was Donald Trump a nice guy? They still came, and even in higher percentages. But there is a crisis in terms of the children. There are much more children and unaccompanied minors coming across. And Biden laid out some of the desperation that these families are facing, which lead them to make these treacherous journeys or, in fact, send off their kids. Let's just listen to what he said.
It's not like somebody's sitting on a hand-hewn table in Guatemala, I mean, in somewhere in Mexico or in Guadalupe saying, I got a great idea. Let's sell everything we have. Give it to a coyote. Have them take our kids across the border into a desert where they don't speak the language? Won't that be fun? Let's go. That's not how it happens. People don't want to leave.
So when you talk to the people who are leaving, what did they say to you? What were some of the reasons that they told you they were leaving? Because he's right. People don't want to leave their countries if they don't have to.
Of course. I mean, they're absolutely desperate for many reasons. I spent a lot of time with Cubans, right? Many Cuban people told me that they're simply being completely surveilled by the government. I think often when we talk about Cuba, it's hard to describe what that type of oppression looks like. Essentially, many migrants told me that they felt suffocated, that they felt like they could not be free. And so that is what impulsed many to take this journey. I was with a lot of migrants from Haiti. The poverty is so excruciating. The violence has gotten to such a point that if you are a father or a mother and you want to give your son a better opportunity, Haiti is not a place where you can envision that future for them, right? And then we also have to think about the pandemic. A lot of these migrants started their journeys. Some of them then started building their lives in countries like Chile or Ecuador, and then came COVID. And under COVID, some of the small opportunities that they had suddenly disappeared. And so many of the migrants that are met are people that restarted their lives in Chile or in Ecuador. And then once again, they saw themselves with no other option but to continue migrating north. And many of the migrants that I met that did this trek through the jungle are now the ones that are stranded in Mexico, still waiting to continue this journey north. And so one of the takeaways is it never really stops. No, they don't really know when the end is. And desperation is so hard that it just it keeps them going on. And that I think is something that is very hard to describe in reporting. It's very hard to show what desperation looks like, to show what would impulse a mom to carry a child through a jungle at night. And I hope that's what we do with this piece.
Well, you did a pretty good job of that, because you can see the desperation. You can see the tiny children. You can see the mothers trying to look after them. You can hear the voices of the civilians, men and women, who are desperate, losing their shoes, having to hike up hills, you know, not having enough food and water, and being terrified. And to that point, you mentioned, you know, a journey from Haiti to Chile and then onwards. A man called Snyderson is somebody who you met on both sides of your trip. And when you got to Panama, you saw that he had got there. And this is what he said to you when he got there.
Mucho mafia en la calle, en el camino. Todo está con pintura. Me quitaron la plata. Me quitaron ropa de mi hijo. Hay mujeres que lo violaron.
¿Usted lo vio?
Sí. Hay cubanos que lo violaron. Le pegaron un tiro. El bebé está delante de él. Él sentaba en el suelo y le tiró un tiro. No. Quitaron la plata a todos, la gente. Y me da ganas llorar. ¿Por qué? Porque no sabe si voy a vivir, si voy a morir, a dejar a mi hijo. No sé. Sí.
Lo siento.
Veo gente que murió en el camino.
¿Viste cuerpos?
Sí, cuerpo murió.
¿Más de uno?
Sí, como tres personas.
No.
Sí. Murió en la calle. Si yo tengo que caminar en este camino para vivir, me prefiero morir.
That is really dramatic testimony. He talks about the assault and rape of women, the killing of people en route, the fact that he lost everything en route, and probably wouldn't have done it again had he known what was in store. You heard a lot of those kinds of stories. What do they do once they get to Panama?
So once they get to Panama, once they finish trekking El Darién, they then have to be transferred to at least three different shelters that are set up by the Panamanian government. And after that, after they go to the third and last one, where they do have some sort of contact with the UN, with UNICEF, and with the Red Cross, they then start the next phase of their journey. They go to Costa Rica, and then from Costa Rica, they start crossing through Central America. And again, Snyderson, just like Yasenia, he's currently in Mexico as well. And so it is just one thing after the other, right? It's this endless journey. And to me, that was one of the most striking things, right? After someone like Snyderson sees those images, right? After he encounters people being raped, after he sees dead bodies, after he sees that his own child can be at risk, this idea of the American dream is so ingrained and so powerful that he has it in him to continue going on. And I think that's one of the things that we keep hearing in this immigration debate. I think what President Biden and what a lot of people are trying to do is to ask the American people that question. If you were someone like Snyderson, what would you do? No, And again, I hope these images speak for themselves.
Except now he's trying to tell them don't come. And he is saying that and the administration is sending, PSAs, public service announcements, taking out ads in parts of Central America to try to get that message across. He's saying that we have to get the infrastructure for proper asylum processing back to where it was before the Trump administration gutted it. So, final question, is that message getting to them, that they should wait, that the Americans will take and process asylum claims, but they need to wait?
It's not. And I think that's the conclusion that I very quickly arrived to through this trek. It's not. You can hear the administration say, don't come just yet. Wait until the border is open. But desperation doesn't know how to wait. No, desperation isn't scared of that. Desperation will take you anywhere. And so what I've found countless times at the border, what I found in El Ayun is that in this moment, there's a lot of mixed messages between what it means to be a country of immigrants, but then have the border closed, right? Between what it means to allow some asylum seekers in, but not some of them. But what I will tell you is that that is certainly not stopping the majority of them to come, because for them, as we just saw, it is a matter of life and death. And in those circumstances, you keep going north.
And of course, for the United States, it's a matter of trying to have a proper immigration reform and a proper immigration future. Paola Ramos, thank you very much indeed for joining us. And you can see her full report this Sunday at Vice on Showtime. Next, the eternal Middle East conundrum. Israel is in gridlock again after a fourth inconclusive election in 2 years, while Palestinians are gearing up for their first election in 15 years. Hamas won the last one back in 2006. And this all has major impact on U.S. policy and especially on that elusive peace deal. The former Palestinian foreign minister, Nasser al-Kidwa, is running in May's parliamentary elections. People are disillusioned with politics as usual, and he has formed a new and independent party. Nasser al-Kidwa is joining me now from Ramallah in the occupied West Bank. Welcome to the program. So, listen, can I start by asking you how you got to this point of running and creating a new party, because you were part of Fatah, you are, you know, the nephew of the Palestinian leader, Yasser Arafat, and now you've been thrown out of the party. Why have you decided that it's so necessary and urgent that you would risk being thrown out of your own historic, you know, political tribe, so to speak?
Well, thank you, Christian, for having me, first. And secondly, let me say this. I was not planning to be expelled from my party, and I don't recognize this expulsion anyway. Let me add also that we don't have a party. We have a gathering, a political gathering, that might develop into something more formal at a later stage. But to answer your question, how did I get here, I think there is a general Palestinian feeling that the situation has got very bad. In terms of both the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and in terms of the internal Palestinian situation. And as such, there was a feeling that there is a need for a change, deep and broad change, that could face those difficulties and try to provide answers. And we have done just that. I mean, we quickly formed this Palestinian National Democratic Assembly, and we established We put together a program, very serious program, comprehensive, that provide not only analysis, but provide answers and moreover, specific tasks for those who might be elected to the Legislative Council at a later stage, so they can be, of course, judged on the basis of that.
So let me ask you, you know, let's just take what you say is wrong with internal Palestinian politics before we address the conflict between you and Israel. You know, I spoke to Hanan Ashrawi, another very well known to the international community Palestinian official. She too resigned, you know, because she didn't like some of what was going on. This is what she told me about what the Palestinian people are sick of and what they want.
We do want good governance. We do want complete representation. We do want an accountable system of government. And like many systems of power that have been in place for a long time, they tend to fossilize with time. And I think what we need is a jolt to jar and to say that this cannot go on anymore.
So, Nasser al-Kidwa, do you agree that Mahmoud Abbas's Palestinian Authority has fossilized?
Well, the main thing is the overall situation. And let me say that I do agree generally with what my friend Hanan said. There is a need for good governance. There is a need for the rule of law. There is a need for a real fight against corruption. There is a need for democratic rights. Among people, we have been always proud people that enjoy our freedoms and exercise this freedom proudly. So it's a bit difficult. It's really difficult for some of us, for all of us probably, to live into or under these conditions, these circumstances. And that's why, again, we want that serious change, deep and broad change.
So let me ask you, because there's talk that potentially Fatah, the dominant party on the West Bank, and Hamas, which is in control of Gaza, might go to these elections in a joint list. Is that even conceivable? What would that actually mean for Palestinian politics vis-a-vis your own society with Israel and with the United States? Would Hamas be acceptable?
Well, unfortunately, it was more than conceivable. I think it was part of a deal that actually was concluded between Fatah and Hamas. And while, by the way, I am big supporters, strong supporters of any attempt to achieve reunification and achieve unity, nevertheless, I thought that deal as something lacking credibility, lacking substance, and something that might lead to even entrenchment of the split rather than ending the split. And that's why I came out publicly against the idea, as well as against the idea of the joint list between Fatah and Hamas. Let me say this also, that the opposition to the idea is great internally inside Fatah and inside Hamas, and that's why it might not take place in real life.
Well, let me just give sort of, you know, numbers to what you mean. The opposition is against. There are polling by a respected Palestinian polling organization that says Mahmoud Abbas, the current president of the Palestinian Authority, would only get 9% in a future election. Ismail Haniyeh, who's head of Hamas in Gaza, would only get 14%. But 22% that said that Marwan Barghouti would get their vote. Now, of course, he is the Palestinian activist and leader who's in jail inside Israel. Is there any way that the system allows Palestinians to vote for a jailed leader? And what would that mean?
I think the system should allow Palestinians to vote to jail leader, to any or any other leader. I mean, it should be free choice for every Palestinian. And I was hoping that Marwan Barghouti, my friend and my comrade, would join our movement and join our trend and support it. Nevertheless, I respect his choices, and let's see what will happen later on when we arrive to the presidential elections. We said that if he runs after the support that should be given to the Palestinian National Democratic Assembly, we would support him. So anyway, this is now left to the future, and we will see what will happen. Generally speaking, polls in the Palestinian society might not be that accurate. It's cultural matter, and by the way, we in the Palestinian NDA are very young, and probably we were not around when this poll was taken.
Right. So let me ask you the obviously the international question, and that is about the peace process. You know, many people don't believe that there is a two-state solution on the table anymore. Do you believe in it? And, well, first of all, do you believe that the two-state solution is possible still to achieve?
There is no doubt about that. It's the only way forward. Nevertheless, let me say this. The term two-state solution has become linked to the never-ended peace process, never-ended perpetual negotiations that is useless, totally useless. But the Palestinian people, for instance, are committed overwhelmingly to their national right, their national identity, their national state, by the way, that does exist by virtue of the natural right of the Palestinian people, by virtue of the historic right, by virtue of international legitimacy, by virtue of the recognition by the majority of states of the state of Palestine. So by virtue of all this, the state does exist under occupation, yes, subject to settler colonialism, yes, but this is the struggle for liberty and national independence. Now, if this comes through negotiations, all the better. Of course, we want that. But unfortunately, the Israeli trend, general trend, which is now proved again to be right and more extreme right, and a little bit of center and things like that. Unfortunately, this trend seems not to be willing to have a serious solution, seems to be wanting everything. So we have ministers that would come publicly and say, this is all ours, utter craziness. That has to end. And I think important part of it has to come from the United States, from the new Biden administration. I hope that this will be the case. And then if this does happen, we will be able probably to move again forward.
So that was going to be my next question, because you just said Israel, you know, makes these claims. And of course, the previous administration, the Trump administration, gave Israel what many called a carte blanche to continue its control of so much of the West Bank, and also broke off diplomatic relations with you, with the Palestinian Authority. Now the Biden administration has said it wants to resume them. They want diplomatic relations with you, the Palestinians. Should you go back to negotiations?
Let me say this. First, there are some Palestinians that they claim all of the land of Palestine as theirs. The only difference that the Israelis saying that now come from the top, come from the cabinet, and that's very dangerous indeed. As far as Trump administration, I think they violated the established U.S. policy before I speak about international law and international positions. U.S. policy itself was drastically violated, and frankly, what Trump administration presented was basically the policy and position of Israeli settlers, extreme right, and the policy and positions of Christian Zionists, if the term is correct, the extreme part of them. That was the deadlock. That was a road that leads to nothing but more blood and more sweat and more suffering and more difficulties. And it should have ended. For Palestinians, to tell you the truth, the most important thing at the time of the U.S. election was who was leaving, not who was coming. And there was a sigh of relief that Mr. Trump has left. And that was very good news, not only for the Palestinians, I think for the whole world as well. Now we want to see a movement back to the established U.S. policy, movement back to respect of international law, a movement back to more balanced policies and position vis-a-vis the Palestinians and the Israelis. And if this happens again, yes, of course, we will be ready to move forward and to meet the other side in the middle based on respect of our mutual rights. And that, let me specify again, respect for the existence of the state of Palestine.
Very, very briefly and finally, I want to ask you, because there's been suggestions of elections in the West Bank for a long time, and each and every one of them have been cancelled over the years. Do you believe that these parliamentary elections in May and then the presidential in July will actually go ahead?
I hope so, and I keep my finger crossed. Let me put it that simple.
All right. Well, there's a lot of finger crossing to be done in your region, and we will continue to follow it. Thank you so much for joining us. Now, the trial of Derek Chauvin, the Minneapolis officer charged with killing George Floyd, is set to begin on Monday. Our next guests delve into the challenges with policing as America grapples with institutional reform. Philip Atiba Goff is one of the country's leading scholars on law enforcement and race. And Tracy Kesey is a former captain with the Denver Police Department. They co-founded the Center for Policing Equity. And here they are talking with our Michelle Martin about strengthening relations with the communities they serve.
Thanks, Christiane. Tracy Kesey, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Philip Atiba Goff, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Dr. Kesey, I want to point out that you're a 25-year police veteran. In addition to your academic work, you retired as a captain of the Denver Police Department. And I do need to note that a police officer was killed as he went to respond to what became a mass casualty event at a supermarket in Boulder. What does this moment bring up for you?
It brings up a lot of things. First, it brings up the emotions and the feelings of when you lose an officer in the line of duty.
the devastation that it brings not only to the community in which he served, but to his family and his seven children that are left behind. To look at what's happening in these last couple of, you know, days tells you just how complex the situations are that we are really truly dealing with when we talk about policing, when we talk about public safety and law enforcement. It is exactly what we talk about when we have yet an officer who ran towards danger as he was trained to take his, you know, lose his life. And then on the other conversation, to have a conversation around how officers are treating Black communities and other communities of color.
There's so many threads in American life are colliding at this point that speak to your work. I mean, the officer who has been charged in connection with the death of George Floyd, that trial is about to begin. The anniversary of the death of Breonna Taylor, her family has just reached a significant settlement with the city of Louisville. Another set of trials that's going forward, or charges that are going forward, are connected to the mob attack on the U.S. Capitol back in January. And one of the disturbing things that has emerged is that a disproportionate number of those currently charged either have ties to the military or ties to law enforcement. What's that about?
It's not new. I can tell you that's what that's about. The issue of white supremacy in the military and in policing is not a new issue. What's new is the fact that the light really now has been shown on it and people have to respond. So the question that a lot of us have, not just, you know, retired officers, but current officers, I'm sure the military the same way, is what do you do? How do you begin to address those issues and those folks that are inside these organizations? And then how do you screen so you don't continue to bring them in? And so again, it's not new, but it also really does add to what the communities across this country have been saying in the way in which they've been treated and the way in which they are being approached about their own public safety. I can tell you a lot of my law enforcement colleagues who were very much about previous administration and being pro-law enforcement, we're at a loss for words when you have a group of people that you continue to claim support law enforcement and yet you take the life of law enforcement. So I think that we really have to have that conversation about what did we really see on that morning? And what we saw was white supremacy on display and folks really not wanting to deal with the outcomes of that.
Is it your sense that some people are attracted to this work because they see it as upholding the authority of a certain group of people over other people? I think some people, I would hope that some people now know the history of, say, the Ku Klux Klan infiltration of police agencies, for example, or sort of the overlap between people who actually belong to white terrorist groups in their off time and then, you know, belong to these law enforcement agencies and the. But I think a lot of people think that that's of the past. I'm sure some people think, well, that's back then, but that's not now.
No, I would say that there may be some who feel that way. But if you really want to ask what's going on inside the organization and the feel of what is happening when we talk about white supremacy, ask officers of color. We on a daily basis have conversations with Black officers from across this country who will tell you they are not only experiencing it, they are navigating it, they are managing it, they're trying to get to retirement because of it. And so when you ask who's really thinking about, you know, who's attracted to this particular profession, you have a lot of thousands of officers who want to serve, who really want to do the right thing. And you have some that are attracted to it for all of the wrong reasons. And part of the conversation that we're having and we continue to have is the tools that are used to screen people in and screen people out. And what we find, you know, even as we look across this country, you can look at processes for people trying to join a police department and you can tell who is going to be screened out before they even get a chance to go into that academy. It's typically Black men and it's typically women of color. And so one of the interesting conversations that's really happening around this, right, and I think this is from the new administration, is to invest millions of dollars into recruiting so police organizations can reflect their community. What is sort of tone deaf about that is not asking about the experiences of Black officers and women in policing to know whether or not that is the way that you want to go. You can certainly invest, millions of dollars are spent in recruiting across this country, but once folks get in, it's completely different than what they were told it was going to be. And unless you deal with the culture of policing, you're not going to retain people.
I'd love to hear more about the culture of police. Maybe Dr. Goff, you want to pick it up here. I'm sure some people are listening to our conversation and they're feeling, well, gosh, I mean, that's a hard job, as evidenced by the fact that a man was just killed for doing it, right? So I think some people would say, well, why would you why would you do that job if you were a bad person, if you wanted to hurt people? The people who do that job are people who want to help people. How can bad things happen if good people who want to help people are doing that job?
You do have people who want to do the right thing for a living show up at the door and say, I'm ready to serve. That's a powerful statement. I'm ready to serve. And they mean that. And they're trained to put themselves between danger and the rest of their community. We can't let go of that and forget that as if that doesn't happen. It just happened then. And I want to bring his name, Officer Goodman, who was a hero on January 6th, where everybody said, look at this black man saving all of Congress. That is a sworn officer, right? It's a sworn officer who was called a traitor by the people on the steps of the Capitol. It's not just about who shows up and does law enforcement. It's also what we allow, what we require law enforcement to do as the residents of communities, right? Law enforcement didn't just show up in Central Park. They were called. Law enforcement didn't decide that they wanted to be the first responders to substance abuse and mental health and homelessness. We decided we were going to take all the money out of the social services that serve those communities, and we were going to send law enforcement instead. Think about that just for a second. As a country, community by community, city by city, state by state, we decided instead of having services for folks who are having the worst time of their lives, we were only going to have that support them, services that help them to get better. We were only going to have services whose job was, whose mission was to determine the need for punishment. So on two levels, we got to get the right people into the job, but we got to decide what the job should be. Because if the job is only going to be wherever there are black and brown people struggling, I want to send badges and guns. I want to send people whose job is to determine, should we take away liberty? Should we take away life? If that's our decision, don't blame law enforcement officers or law enforcement executives for the fact that that's what happens when they show up. Blame us, because we kept deciding that that was the mission of law enforcement. So that double duty, getting the right people in, but deciding the right mission for those people, that's what communities across the country are figuring out. If we want to shrink the size, the footprint of the way that we punish, what could public safety look like? And the reason you're hearing people say reimagine is because often we're stuck in the trap that either you got to have cops or you have lawlessness, as if there's no other way to put a society together.
Now talk about that, because you've mentioned a number of jurisdictions as a way to reimagine the way policing is done, the way justice is done, have elected, say, reformist prosecutors. And that's important because, you know, prosecutors determine, you know, what cases will be brought and how those cases will be disposed of. Presumably they're going to change the incentives for the behavior on the that's happening on the street. But what we've seen in a number of these jurisdictions is a furious reaction to these reformist moves, even though these are people who are elected, you know, by the people. But what do you make of that? Like, what does that say?
I think it's really clear that there's some forms of power that are being threatened in a way that they don't like, right? And I want to be also clear, this too is not new. Whenever folks came by and said, the power that shapes the United States into a white supremacist society is going to be challenged, white supremacy said, hey, I forgot about us, we're still here. That's where violence happens, mass violence, where threats happen, where the FBI is mobilized against this notion of just black liberation. If you think about a sort of simpler version of it, not just progressive prosecutor, but the battle cry that sort of cohered this moment in the long struggle for black emancipation and liberty, black lives matter? How anodyne a statement is that? Black lives are nifty. Black lives are not to be degraded, to be discarded without. That has led to folks calling for further prosecution, to new federal penalties for black identity extremists. When power is threatened, this is what you see. And the power in the United States is not just corporate power, though it's also that. It's not just elected power, though it's also that. It's also the power of white racial politics. And it is being threatened right now more directly than we've seen over the past several decades.
Dr. Keyes, what are your thoughts about this? Do you see an appetite for in these departments for, what do you see as a person who's done that job, who's been on the street, who's been in the patrol cars, who's been on patrol and who works with people, you know, throughout your career and now, of course, has a look at it from a research perspective? What do you see?
As we look at the work that's going on across the country, what you see are communities exercising their power, where historically it has been sort of counted on that they weren't paying attention or they were just good with it. What is interesting about that power and what we see in the conversations that we're having with our chiefs, we have a lot of chiefs that really want to make sure that they are providing the right type of service for the community. I'm going to say that just flat out. They want to see it. Where you find a lot of the struggle happening is understanding how that should happen and what does it look like. There is a tremendous amount of concern in regards to, as you know, we've all been talking about, what do we do and how do we sort of help get through this sort of spikes in violent crime? How do we make sure that victims need services, get those services? And so we're really trying to manage that piece. That's in addition to how do those services really, in an equitable sense, get even sort of parsed out. So if you have folks that have mental health issues, and you'll hear this in law enforcement, there isn't a chief that will tell you we should be the number one folks answering those calls for people in mental health crises. They just won't. But what they will tell you is there are some of those calls as well where you have folks who have not been on their meds that may be violent. How do we help protect those workers who are going in, who we believe are the right people to be going in? So you hear those really healthy conversations happening.
I'm thinking about that, the case and another case from Colorado, Elijah McClain in Aurora, Colorado. And he's walking along the street, going home. He's tackled by police officers for no reason that anybody can determine, really. He's injected with a powerful sedative and he dies. And how do we think about something like this? I mean, what needs to change so that something like this does not happen again?
There was a lot of work done after Elijah McClain's death. They did an incredible review of the entire process to even say that the stop was not legal, but what he needed was a mental health service. Even, you know, as you go on these calls, like most of us have, and you walk into these spaces and you yourself are saying, I'm not what these people need. I'm not what they need, but all I have is this. So if there's something in there that may be able to provide some level of comfort or provide some level of service, then if I can, I will. The number one thing we're hearing really around some of the pushback on the reimagining work is, well, if you get rid of, you know, first the narrative is, well, you're going to get rid of all the armed officers. That's not it. It is really reduce that footprint to have the officers doing exactly what they say they want to do, and that's crime. When we do the analysis on 911 calls, you know, at least 2-4% of those calls are violent crime. The rest are social service calls. That tells you that we're out of alignment here about what we should be doing and providing with community.
Another sort of issue that has emerged in recent weeks, even though it's clearly been going on for quite some time, is the rise in assaults on people of Asian descent. And I'd like to ask you, how do you think we should think about this? Because you're already seeing in the conservative media a desire to move the focus to Black on Asian crime. That is happening. That is a thing that is happening. We're seeing a renewed focus on, again, this notion that defunding the police is the cause of this spike in assaults. Okay, how do you think we should think about this? How should we be talking about this?
Yeah, so I think part of the reason why it's confusing in the space that we're at right now is because we've been so dishonest about our history. Right. When you have folks at the bottom of the social hierarchy fighting with each other, it's really easy to take the camera lens, focus in on them and say, why do they hate each other so much? And not zoom out and say it's in part because they've been given so few resources. There are other people who are benefiting from this. Right. So part of the way that we should be thinking about this is that you've got immigrant communities with, you know, born in the United States or native to the United States communities that are put in terrible positions of vulnerability, economic vulnerability, and a lack of social power. So that creates tensions because ain't nobody got enough in those communities. Those tensions become racialized in the service of folks who are extracting all of the resources out of those communities in the first place. If we had a broader lens, a broader understanding of who's actually benefiting and who's actually suffering, we would blame the folks who have very little far less than we do. The other piece of this is that we tend to frame conflict in the United States around race as if only Black people and white people exist, as if it's not that contest, that that sin of slavery, we call it the original sin. But how do you have stolen people doing all this labor unless you also have land that's been stolen? right? So the genocide towards Native and brothers and sisters on this country, we have to acknowledge that. And the imported indentured servitude that Chinese laborers got to do when they were forced to build railroads, also an incredible, backbreaking, disgusting, racialized form of violence that helped build the capital and the resources of the country. So when we frame racism as if it's a white thing happening to Black people, and we don't frame it as part of this larger project of extraction of resources from Black folks and Brown folks and Red folks, right, from Asian folks and Native folks, everybody, right, if we don't frame it that way, then it's easy to think that the problem is between whoever we catch on camera in that moment.
I wanted to ask what you think the Biden administration should be doing right now.
So one of the things that we want to make sure is happening, especially with this new administration, is there is an understanding that policing is really local. We have violence interrupters throughout this country who have stepped in communities and have done things that police could not do. You have to invest in that work that's happening. And there seems to be, for some reason, a reason not to want to do that, to want to put it in some kind of structure that feels acceptable other than what may work and doesn't look like the way we think it should. There are a lot of things I believe in the George Floyd Act that will be helpful for us. We always talk about data collection. In some of that work, there's conversations about collecting data. For us, you collect everything. Do not sort of restrict, be very clear. And we have, you know, a lot of things on our website that helps guide those things where you can figure out what should everybody be collecting. So we truly can begin to look at what we need to do and to supplement the work that's happening on the ground.
The thing that I want folks to be able to do, as you've been hearing bits and pieces of, I want us to gain a kind of historical literacy with consequences. There are things that we have done in this country to accumulate wealth and power in incredibly concentrated ways. And it's always been on the backs of immigrants and darker skinned folks, right? That is not known, not as widely as it needs to be. It's not acknowledged, and we don't act on it. So if we don't have a full accounting of the ways in which this country has benefited from our terrible treatment of vulnerable folks, there's no way to build the structures that prevent that exploitation going forward, including policing.
Tracy Kesey, Philippa Tibagoff, thank you both so much for speaking with us today and sharing your expertise.
Thank you, Michelle.
Thank you so much, Michelle.
So much acknowledging and such a reckoning still to be done. And finally tonight, a musical odyssey to one of the most remote places on Earth. Mahani Teve's love for classical music began as a child, when the first piano arrived on Rapa Nui, or Easter Island, as it's best been known ever since the first European explorer named it back in 1772. She went on to become an international concert player, here performing Chopin in Seattle from her new album, Rapa Nui Odyssey. But then Mahani gave it all up to create the first music school at home. It's a fascinating story, and Mahani Teve is joining me now from Rapa Nui. Welcome to the program. I mean, I'm really excited because we've never had anybody join us from so far away. I think you're 2,000 miles off the coast of Chile in the Pacific. So tell me what and why you decided to end your, you know, your global concert career and take it back home.
Hello, Christian, Yorana, Tato. Well, thank you so much for the invitation to the program. About ending a career, I don't think it was that was exactly my intention, but I did have the feeling that I needed somehow to help my island and the children that were here, that I had had the chance to pursue this musical dream, but all the talents that are here on the island that needed developing and nurturing were not having that chance. So I felt, okay, there's so many wonderful musicians out there. I think they don't need, another pianist. I wanted to play because I want to give the music to the people. And I did want to continue doing the concerts, which I did. But my idea was not to continue, you know, playing concerts every other day or things like that. So it was to actually be able to combine both things, to do the concerts, but also to be able to create a music school on the island to give the chance to the children here.
So tell me, when you were a child, you encountered your first piano. Was it the first piano on the island? How did that get to you? And how did you learn? How did you become a pianist?
Well, it was somehow just in my blood, this desire to do music. And when the first piano arrived, I was just so excited. I had heard a bit of classical music from the ballet classes I was having. A teacher had come for a year and then she left, but I had the chance to listen, you know, to Nutcracker and other beautiful music, and I was just overwhelmed with the desire to learn the piano. And when that chance happened, it was just amazing. And a year later, the teacher was, or a few months later, actually, like 10 months later, the teacher was having to leave the island, and a famous Chilean pianist came to the island and heard me and told my family, you know, if you want to give your daughter the opportunity to study, you'd better leave the island, because otherwise she won't be able to develop that talent. So we moved to Chile, and later I had the chance to continue studying in the United States with an amazing teacher whom I profoundly admire and love, Sergei Babayan. And then I continued in Germany, and it was just a tremendously enriching chance that I was having to be able to develop and grow in this, which I love so much.
Well, it's amazing. You brought all these gifts back for the children of your homeland, of your island. And also, you have made it a point to create this school out of all sorts of stuff that's been left there by tourists. Tell me about what you're doing for the environment and how you built the school.
Yes, well, our idea with other Rapa Nui dreamers, I would say, who also went out of the island to study and bring back tools to help our land, was in a way to be able to from the different aspects of environment and music and nature and medicine, to be able to help the island in a way, because we want to help the planet. But the place where you need to start is at your own home, you know. And our idea was that by doing this on the island, that is like a small cosmos in itself, we could somehow maybe inspire other places as well. And maybe ideas could come that could be replicated in other places. So we created NGO Toki Rapa Nui and built the first music school with recyclable materials, the so-called garbage. We did it in a model called Earthship Biotecture, led by Michael Reynolds, and we have 6 years of garbage in our walls, and solar panels, rainwater collectors, thousands of tires, and tens of thousands of bottles and cans. And other of the founders are leading projects that are also related to sustainability, like the self-autonomy, like the food sustainability of the island through agricultural projects, which can help diminish the carbon footprint of the bringing of all these products from outside. And the idea is in a way that we can bring back this ancestral knowledge, this cosmovision where we are complete beings. Like through the music, we cultivate our intellect, our spiritual, our emotional part, but we also need to be taking care of our body through what we eat, our planet. We have to be aware and take responsibility about everything that we are doing daily. On a daily basis is where we actually start making a change. And not waiting either for governments to make a change, because that's too slow.
Yeah. Of course, we all do need the world's governments to get on with it. But we've just been looking at pictures of the ancestral stone structures that Easter Island, Rapa Nui, is so famous for. And we're going to play a performance of yours. It's taken from ancestral music. What is it about this piece that you find special that we're going to play?
This is a song that's very memorable to our people because it tells the story of the first king of the island who arrived with the original ancestors of ours, the Rapa Nui, who were emigrating from a land called Hiva that was having a natural catastrophe. And so they were searching for a land for our people, and they arrived in Rapa Nui. And this is the story of the king. When he's about to pass away, he calls the spirits of homeland Hiva to take him back. So it's a very, it's like the hymn of the anthem of the island, in a way.
Well, that's great, and we're going to play it after we say goodbye. So thank you so much. And a new documentary on Mahani Teavai's life, Song of Rapa Nui, is available now on Amazon Prime. And as I said, we leave you with more of her wonderful music. Thanks for watching, and goodbye from London.
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country, Beyonce and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.